Hello.
Hey.
We're here. This is bi-weekly number 36. Hossa here. It's me, Dima Valenko, and on the other line is...
I'm Slava Rudnitsky, and today we are going to talk about a book.
A book about big things and about how they get done. Hopefully, sort of, maybe, sometimes.
But before we get this thing done, we should discuss the follow-up.
I have two bits of follow-up here. One is that discombobulation continues. It turns out our good friend of the podcast, Liana, in comment to the video on YouTube, mentioned that there is apparently a song by artist by the name Eminem, which is called Discombobulation. Who knew? But apparently this is a thing. And lo and behold, there was another podcast like last week I listened to, and they also were discombobulated about something. I don't know. I wanted to check Google search term for the word discombobulation, but I failed to do so before the podcast. Maybe this will be a follow-up for the next time if we have a huge spike of discombobulation on the internet.
Yeah, and you should also see that the date of this spike started just when you mentioned it for the first time, and then like...
Pfft. Right. So then I'll add to my resume that I'm a trendsetter. So this is, with the discombobulation aside, I had, we do journaling, you do journaling, I try to do journaling, we discussed notebooks and stuff. I don't think we talked much about pens. I, for the longest time, I've been using my trusted Pilot G2 pens, and in recent, I guess that would be recent weeks, I had two very unpleasant incidents with them. I like pens that have a very fine tip. So, and most pens that are sold everywhere are not that. So they had a thicker tip, and I don't like that. For I kind of look for pens and refills that have very, very thin, very fine, very, very fine tin tip. And with Pilot G2s, a long time ago, I bought a whole bunch of refills with extra ultra fine or extra fine tip, and I've been using them ever since. But then recently I had an incident where kind of the tip broke and it became basically unusable. And I said, okay, and it was almost full still. I said, like, all right, maybe I'll get another refill. I'll use it all the way up and change the tip and kind of recoup that that ink. And I started using a new refill, and kind of in less than a week it went down with the similar problem. So I was on the market for new pens. I've got some. Yeah, we'll see how it goes.
Best of luck there. It could be a journey for years.
Right. And I tried to kind of hedge my bets there and opted for Pilot G2 is a gel pen, and I thought, like, maybe there's like something about the gel pens there. And I found highly recommended or highly regarded, like, regular ball pen with extra fine tip, and I wonder if it's going to last any longer than those G2s.
As my partner says, give it a try and see what happens.
Yep, now that's, I guess, what's going to happen. But I found that this is, for me, this was important to have kind of writing instruments that I kind of like and enjoy using. So
I feel you.
Cool. On to the book, I guess.
Yep.
Tell us. I think it was your recommendation that we read and discuss this book. How come?
And I totally don't remember how I bumped into it. My assumption is that it was a podcast, but I can't really recall because it was like months ago and many things happened. But most of the audiobooks that I get come from podcasts. So I guess it should be something like Focused or something along those lines. But somehow it happened, and I listened to this book in like two walks and then one drive. So it's not a big one. And I think the core idea seems intriguing. So this is something I wanted to discuss with you, is how you make big things happen.
Mm-hmm.
And the principles that the author suggests are debatable, but quite interesting.
I agree with that. So to our listeners, the book discusses big projects, right? Like big on the scale of worldwide visible kind of things, right?
And the title of the book, we should probably want to know by now, is How Big Things Get Done.
Right. Yeah, seasoned podcast book reviewers didn't mention the book that we are talking about. All good here. Yeah, the book is How Big Things Get Done. Would you be able to pronounce author's name?
Don't think so.
I think he is a Dane. Currently, he is a professor in University of Oxford, something along those lines. Yeah, and this is the book. I think I got it that this is book based on his experience as a scholar and consultant for big projects.
Mm-hmm. Shall we go through the outline, or we can jump straight to the questions?
I think we can maybe do a little bit of an overview of an outline. But before we do that, I think that there is a very worthy question that we can address first. And that would be the question, who do you think this book is for? What I mean by that is, do you think this is a book for project managers to learn from? Is this a book for general public to be amazed by how big projects are unsuccessful and stuff like that? Or is it something else entirely?
I would say this is a book that gives food for thoughts for people who have ambitions to scale something up. And these could be community leaders, project managers, politicians, whoever considers global ambitions. Definitely not project managers. Even though I found a handbook that is being created right now for mega projects, they're picking the tools how to manage vast things.
Right. I think I share this similar sentiment. Even though the book appears to be full of advice on how to manage projects and stuff like that, I don't really think it is. To be honest, I think of it more of a kind of general public kind of thingy. Or like, look at this cool thing that I found in my experience. Let me tell you an interesting story about that kind of thing.
It is. And the style is also quite light. It's storytelling. So it's these kind of Harari kind of books.
Harari kind of books is the first time I hear that such term. Like, what does that mean?
I didn't remember. Who was the author of the blocks, Black Swan?
That's Nassim Taleb.
Like, Taleb, Harari, like this category of people who have a single idea and then they just tell 200 stories about this idea in different angles.
Yep. I guess that's fair. Maybe would it be fair to also characterize it as a book that is sort of unscientific, meaning that it lacks sort of scientific like rigor, but attempts to be a little bit scientific-y or something along those lines?
I'd say it's kind of based on the empiric experiments, and these guys were studying a number of projects, so they were probably not mentioning it during the book, but if you look at their website, like there is this database of mega projects that they are referring to during the book a few times. So I would say that it's not aiming to be scientific. But when scientists write something, they just kind of can't
help themselves
change.
Can be. Maybe let me try to do like a super quick overview of the ideas in the book without going into details. And I think it kind of matches the outline, right? So the idea, the big thing there is that the big projects in general fail because they fail to meet kind of budgets or schedule or fail to deliver what they promised to deliver. And big projects do much more spectacularly so because they're big. So that kind of this is the premise of the book. And then the author suggests a number of things that could be done differently to hopefully help that. First would be to, instead of jumping to action, kind of do thinking and sort of planning beforehand, then not committing too early to stuff, not jumping to do once again that reiteration of the same idea, not jumping to dig the hole, but first thing. And because when the hole is dug, commitment fallacy kind of kicks in. Keeping the goal of the project in mind at all times, like knowing what you build and making sure that you're moving towards that, like do rigorous planning, whatever it means, and then hire experienced people to work on the project. Like when you're working on something, get people who had done similar things, and then don't think that your project is too unique. It may have share more similarities to project of a similar kind. And then, the chapter 7, I'm struggling a little bit. Can ignorance be your friend is the title. I don't remember the exact idea there. Is it just...
Actually, last three chapters were kind of messy. I think the 9th is the most important here because he suggests the way out of these things is the modularity and that right. Things should be chopped into small, repeatable items.
Right. So, that was the last idea. And before that was that you want a good team working on your project, like a team as in team cohesion and efficiency, which all of those ideas independently, they do sort of make sense, but there are interesting quirks about the book, I think.
Before we get into the questions, do you regret reading the book?
No. I think.
Did you enjoy reading the book?
As in many cases, I guess I sort of enjoyed thinking about what I read in the book, and then kind of doing some sort of analysis for why I agree or disagree with what author says. Like this, I definitely kind of enjoyed.
Then may I suggest that at first I tell you three things I enjoyed and ideas that I find useful before we get into this long list of...
let's do that. But then I'll do a prepared remark before people jump
to conclusions. I've got a new... Oh my God. T-L-O?
What's
T? A? T-L-A. T-L-A,
T-L-A. Yeah.
Three-letter abbreviation, yep. And it's the old one, it's MVP, but we know MVP as minimum viable product, and he suggests maximum virtual product, which I find really fascinating as an idea. And since I have the development and construction background, I know how detailed these things could actually get now. You can count the number of screws you need and a lot of other things if you pay attention. But if you just draw something and then hope that it gets done and you let someone design it, calculate it, and build it on spot, of course, like it's way different. These days, software allows you design things very, very, very much in detail. And it works not just with software. Let's say we wanted to make a huge education initiative. I think it can be scripted and drafted in very much details. You can see what the lessons are going to be. You can definitely see the user experience before you build the thing. So I think that this is an amazing idea. And next time I jump into something big, I will definitely spend more time building this maximum virtual product first.
Cool. It makes a lot of sense.
All right. The second one is I noted it down as politics and decision making. The author mentioned the commitment fallacy. We know it as sunk cost fallacy, and there are many other things, but definitely I have a tendency to ignore stakeholders in the project. I get very engaged and in love with what should be done, and I forget how people stake their reputation on it. And the people factor killed so many projects that I liked, mm-hmm. just because they weren't popular enough, weren't going the way we expected or something. They were still great, but this decision-making mechanism around thing. And probably what I take away from this chapter or section is that I should definitely keep the lobby as an ongoing thing that popularizes the project, highlights the importance, works with the benefits, works mm-hmm. with different stakeholders to keep it running.
Yep, plus one to that.
Oh, and the third one is something you mentioned as rigorous planning, but I think we've covered it quite enough, so we can skip that one.
Cool. Yep.
Did you like anything?
No, wait. As I tried to explain before we started recording, like the notes I put in here just for me to hopefully sort of maybe get some of the details right. And but my general impression of the book is that the ideas are very sound. Like all of those nine or however many things that we discussed, we covered thus far, and the items that you highlighted, the three things, they make a lot of sense to me, and I almost fully subscribe to them. I think what the book doesn't, at least to my taste, and it, I guess maybe it would be fair to say that it did meet my expectations for how it did two things. First, kind of articulated and provided grounds to explain why the proposed ideas are good ideas. So the justification or rationale for those ideas at times was dubious to my taste. Mm-hmm. And second is that the author did not really provide useful practical means for how those ideas could be implemented. And I think one of the sort of fallacies of the book is that it does apply a lot of retroactive thinking to things that already happened. And everyone can be wise with the benefit of hindsight, but what's interesting to discuss is like, all right there in the moment, how do you practice those things? Because I can, as a consultant, I can always come in and say, like, do things right, don't do things wrong, and kind of say, like, of course, and then retroactively explain how people did not follow my advice over here, and that's why they fail. But how to do things right there in the moment is a billion sort of dollar question, which I don't feel like book provides a satisfactory answer to.
Definitely. It's like the joke about an owl and mice, right? When the mice came to an owl saying, like, everyone harms us, we are in danger, like, what should we do? The owl says, you should become hedgehogs. They're like, yay, we should become hedgehogs. And then they come back in a week, like, but oh, how do we become hedgehogs? Like, I don't know, I'm not a practitioner.
Right. Yep, I think there is a little bit of it, and the book overall had this consultancy feel to me a little bit.
What I enjoyed about the style, though, is that it kind of goes across industries, like from the construction to huge industrial things, cultural things, some tech examples, and movie industry. And this was nice because I guess that when you read stuff from people who are deep experts in something, let's mm-hmm. say like a TV producer, and this person only shares, I think it was about the book Tell to Win that mm-hmm. We discussed some time ago.
Right.
When the person is solely in one domain, it kind of makes the book more predictable. And here I didn't like some of the stories. I'm not sure they were related to the point that he tried to support, but the stories were nice.
Interesting. Was there any story that you liked in particular?
Like the Australian Opera House in Sydney?
Mm,
okay. I didn't really know much about it. And
yeah, that's that one was interesting. And the story there was that it was there was a competition, right? There was some sort of a public competition, and there was this young Dutch or Danish architect who won the competition with a very mesmerizing is not the right word, but very impressive drawing for the outline or the shape of the opera house, and they committed to that project without doing due diligence on, like, is it even feasible and how to make it feasible and so on and so forth. And there were massive cost, schedule, whatever else, overruns, and the architect themselves had to almost flee Australia because he was kind of ousted from the project.
Yeah, and I still think it's successful because, like, we know this place.
Right. I think I have, and maybe we can come back to this Australian project, Australian Opera House project as well. While we were on the topic of style, there were, I found, to my taste, like, four distinct elements how I didn't really like the style of book. And I wonder if the first one, where the author uses a lot of kind of, he throws in a lot of kind of profoundly sounding observations or terms, like iron law of mega projects, like the window of doom, like bias this, fallacy that. And sometimes he even uses names of those things that are different from well-known names, like the commitment fallacy, I think, is known to us, as you mentioned, as a sunk cost fallacy and stuff like that. And I like, yeah, seriously? Like, what's so iron about this law of mega projects? And like, why the window of doom? And I got distracted a little bit. And I think every chapter had something along those lines, like a kind of big, profoundly sounding statements. That was one thing on the style. The second thing on the style was there was a lot of references to other people and to other publications, but in not in an academic reference sort of way, but in a style of like that famous joke that goes around, and how's it, mother's friend son has done XYZ and therefore it means that, like, we can draw enormous conclusions. So I felt a lot of the reference are like this style, like unexpected events happen. Yeah, unexpected event happens, but do we really need to throw in black swans and Nassim Taleb there? Like, does it really help the discussion? Maybe not. It's just sounds a lot of times like a little bit of appeal to authority. Did you notice anything like that, or is it just me being oversensitive?
I think I filter those things out, like, because at certain level I will either get really frustrated and I stop listening to the book itself because I get stuck in the specific things. Mm-hmm. This is what happened to me at a strategic session training in Kyiv Mohyla Business School. Like, I was so stuck on every sentence, there were so many biases and fallacies that I couldn't get the idea. And then I talked to people who were just less strict, mm-hmm. and they said, yeah, like these five thoughts were useful. And it made me reconsider, because I did spend 2 days in these filters and didn't get the main point, because the way it was delivered was not sound for me. Like, mm-hmm. there were lots of stereotypes and disrespect and biases and many other things. And it made me reconsider the way I go through materials, because mm-hmm. if there is something useful I can get from it, maybe this is what I should focus on.
That's fair. I think I put on my book critic hat for this podcast, for this discussion, and I do notice that I read books and kind of perceive them differently when I just read them for the sake of interest, and when I read them knowing that we would plan to discuss it. And there have to be things hopefully interesting and hopefully entertaining to say about the book.
That definitely is, and that's in the spirit of our first book club from first season.
Right.
I think it was Simon Sinek Start With Why, which basically started a generation of book discussions that were similar, but in that book you noted something like 12 pages of...
Yeah, that was a lot. I think I still have those notes somewhere in here.
That does make sense. So, shall we move to the next note on style?
Yes, the next one was... And this is more subtle, and I wonder what you think about this. I also felt like there is little counterfactual examples to the ideas that author proposes. So he would throw in the idea, do XYZ. Here is an example of a project that did XYZ and it was successful, or at the very best, here is the example of a project where they didn't do XYZ, and hypothetically, if they did XYZ, they would be successful. But there was no... I cannot remember of an example where I would say, like, oh, like, this is the idea, this is how it doesn't work, or here are the conditions under which this would not be applicable or would not work. So that part was a little bit missing.
I think that's an issue with bigger models. Like, whenever you put a number of factors, it has 9 or 7 or whatever number actually is, it's really hard to work with evidence because you can't really find projects that match all 7. And you have to find a project that, for example, does planning only and show the importance of this factor in this project, but Y and Z could be missing there. And then it's really hard to estimate the value of each of these criteria, because when you have a number of factors that influence, and if 3 of them are missing, the others were still useful, but they didn't make the project successful.
Right. And I think that kind of points into, like, overall occasional dissatisfaction with some of the examples that he was giving, where indeed, like, each project has a multitude of factors that influence its success, and he focuses on this particular one without really providing any background or justification for why this particular factor was important for this particular project. And I think that
it does feel like a set of articles. Like, let's say there are 7 articles that randomly prove 7 different points.
But and I think an example of that, where kind of this sort of maybe a little bit, not necessarily dishonest, but somewhat not holistic kind of presentation of projects and problems and their analysis that rubbed me the wrong way. You remember the story about the kitchen renovation project?
Oh my God, that was the least, like, I scrolled it, or like I speeded it up every time he mentioned it.
Okay, so but for but I think this is a good example of how kind of the presentation style in the book is a little bit kind of twisted and spinny. The gist of the project there was that there was a couple in Brooklyn in New York. They occupied the first 2 floors of older, like, 1940s era building, and they decided to do a kitchen renovation, and they kind of started the project, and then when they started actual execution, they removed the flooring and discovered that the base of the entire building is weak and not up to the standard, need to be reinforced, which is a much bigger thing, but they had to commit to that because otherwise, like, nothing can be done. And then they step by step, this project blew out of proportion, so they had to live for literally years outside of their house and spend like 3-4 more times than they originally planned on this thing. And like the first thing is that when he was first describing how the project failed, he said, all right, they discovered the weak foundation. As an unfortunate risk, thing can happen. They committed and kind of continued to do the thing. But then there was this literally phrase, the wife's mom suggested, why don't you renovate the second floor of the flat? And I'm like, well... like, this is the problem. They have had enormous scope scope creep right there. And he doesn't talk about that. But then later on, he talks about how it's important for projects to know the end goal of the project and work towards that goal. And then he says that, oh, like this kitchen renovation project, it has a wrong goal in the first place. If they spend time figuring out the goal, they would know that they don't want to do kitchen renovation project. Instead, they need to do to renovate, rebuild the entire house. And I'm like, wait a minute, like in the first place, they know what they wanted to do. They wanted to do kitchen renovation, but for whatever reason, they threw in like renovation of the entire house. Like, this is not a problem with the goal of the project. This is a problem with sticking to the goal of the project. And then this kind of later on, this explanation that they had the wrong goal, it was an illustration of the idea of thinking to the right and understanding the project goal, but it was applied to this project entirely retrospectively, right? He says, oh, if they think about the overall goal of this thing, they would arrive that they want to renovate the entire house. Like, how do we know that they would arrive at that? They may arrive like, no, we just need a kitchen for $200,000 and that's it. So this kind of things where the same example is looked from only one side, which is convenient for the story, for the part of the story that he tells at one time, but then spinning it around almost entirely in a different place. I think it was not uncommon in this book, and I didn't like it.
That is fair, but once again, there was a counterexample of Pixar, which I think he explained in a lot of details, and there were supposed to illustrate the idea of planning when they spend a lot of time visualizing what has to happen, how it has to happen, go through all these MVP drafts and presentations and critics. And I didn't have issues with industrial projects, but this kitchen was probably something to make the book more readable for unprepared users, like for people who don't have much experience in building opera houses and nuclear power plants. And most people can refer to this kitchen innovation. I think he overused it in general. And if it just happened once to illustrate his point and then that's it, I wouldn't feel any issues about it. But then it was mentioned like 6 or 7 times later in the book. And this is where I felt a bit irritated. But as I mentioned, I just pressed like plus 15 seconds and it was gone.
Okay. Yep, that makes sense. But also here, like, don't get me wrong. Maybe out of the entire book, I think this is the overall most valuable idea. Like, understand what it is that the project is doing. And I, in my line of business, in my work, I talk to people like, what is the problem statement for what your project is doing? What is, and I want them to formulate this as a checkbox that can be ticked only after the project is complete. But then that implies that ticking that box is important. You would understand why this thing is done and work towards that. And I think it plays for both this the kitchen project. If we understand that we are doing kitchen renovation, we should not have started doing the whole house renovation. Or if we feel like, oh, this is turning into full house renovation, we should make a conscious decision, an explicit decision. All right, we are now not in the kitchen project. Let's stop, pause, and kind of redo the thing for the new project with the new problem statement. And I think this is so very important for success of the project. And this is the idea in the book, but the way how it was presented and justified makes me a little bit unhappy. I think that there can be a stronger argument made for this idea.
It can. But even without this strong argument, it made me think. And this is why I was grateful, because we are about to start for medium-sized projects, not large ones, but medium ones. And I definitely have a tendency to skip the planning stage, not skip entirely, but to do it not as thoroughly as I could. And after reading this book, I do spend much more time considering what is the outcome and desired end state.
And I think also this idea of kind of understanding what the project is really meant for, and I think it is very connected with the idea of jobs to be done, kind of the concept and approach for figuring out what it is that we really should be doing. I think it also connects to the planning sort of exercise, because in case of Pixar, the way I understand, I was not there in Pixar, but the way I understand their projects and from the books I've read about Pixar is that the end goal for them is not to have a film that can be produced with kind of successful budget. The goal for them is to have a compelling story that people are going to watch, right? And if we, the goal is not the film per se. It is the story, the film, the animation is the medium for delivering the story. And the goal is to find that story that would resonate to people and then present it in the best possible way. And if you think about the project from that perspective, it only makes sense that they spend a lot of time not in planning, but in actually building their project, building the story, which author calls planning in this sense. And then, yeah, when you have the story, when you have the narrative, then turning that into animated film, I would not go as far as to say it's just a technicality, but then it removes a whole bunch of complexity from the enterprise there.
Well, I think I got his point there a bit differently, because he was basically comparing Pixar to the entire movie industry and saying that the movie industry in general is impacted a lot by sunk cost fallacy. And in Pixar, according to him, the moment when you invest a lot comes way later in the process. Like most companies, they just see the script, they do the very approximate budget, they jump in, and then when they spend half of the budget within first month, they realize it will cost more. And the overall over budget thing in movie production is incredible. That's how I got his point. And the fact that Pixar, before investing a lot, does a lot of pre-stages kind of saves them from this.
I think it's a little bit of an unfair comparison on author's side, because he compares kind of the worst, he takes a worst example of execution, which was, I think, some of the movie, but don't remember the name, which ruined the entire studio, because the director there said, like, yeah, I don't care about the budget, and I'll start shooting, and whoever, the investors, the studios, will have to keep funding me to get this thing completed. Of course, if you do it like this, it's not going to end well. But it does not necessarily prove the point that the way the other project is done is kind of a counterexample to this thing. And with Pixar specifically, we don't know about how many ideas that they develop or kind of start working on, kind of go through iterations which go nowhere, which means that the cost, even however small it is, it not insignificant, right? This cost is completely buried. Like, it's like zero return on that investment. We don't talk about that. We talk about the successful examples of how they kind of did this development, and it turned out to be a great film there. And I think I'm not sure about the author per se. He didn't talk about this in the book. How much of internal data he had access to, but the data on budgeting for films is not entirely public. The studios published the final budget of the film, but we never know what was the initial budget. And like the two examples, two slightly counterfactual things that I found was that the first huge success for Pixar was the movie Toy Story, the first completely computer animated feature film. Their initial budget was 17 million, but overall budget ended up to be 30 million, which is almost two times overrun there. And significant costs were incurred in that planning stage when they iterated in the story. They figured that they went into a sort of dead end and had to redo a whole bunch of stuff on the planning stage. So yes, this works, but it also comes with cost, and these costs are difficult to predict. And Inside Out, we only know the final budget for the film. We don't know initial budget for the film to judge on the overrun, but at that planning stage there were several delays because they needed more time to work on the story. They felt like the story is overall very promising, but they didn't like what they had, so things had to be reworked and delayed. And this also had to come with cost, right? And this could have been the overrun for this project. So I think it's a bit unfair to say that, oh, like those poor guys that do not break before they hit the wall don't work. Look at our perfect braking system that we have here, and look how much more benefit it gives.
That's actually the first time I feel that I'm happy I didn't go that deep, because normally fact checking is a thing that I can spend a lot of time in. This is what happens here. I know some things about Ukrainian movie production as well, and it doesn't work that way because most of Ukrainian movies are not made by private investors, but by state. Mm-hmm. And it's a fixed amount of money that mm-hmm. people have to fit in, or they pay from their own pockets. And it also kind of disciplines the movie makers. But I think Hollywood is a bit different, and there is a lot of unclear way people get funding. Mm-hmm. Like even the Ministry of Defense supports some of the films. So it is kind of messy. But summarizing this Pixar thing, it kind of refers to this MVP, mm-hmm. Maximum Virtual Product idea, that if you can see the initial reaction to your project, discover it, explore it, see how it goes, and as it develops, you can refer to it and compare, like, is our assumption working out? That makes a lot of sense. And before Pixar, before the chapter on Pixar, I've never thought about all these intermediate stages. Like, I think I feel it's right, but I was never conscious about it.
No, I think, like, and don't get me wrong, once again, I'm like wholeheartedly with two or three, however many hands I have up for careful planning, for doing things to reduce ambiguity and unknownness and uncertainty for the project. And like same in software, you can spend the time that you spend kind of figuring out, once you figured what you want to build, like figuring out the most effective way to do that and discovering things that can go or work against that upfront, it helps tremendously. It's just my disagreement here is like with how this idea is illustrated, and the examples that might be a little bit misleading for those who are a little bit in the know with how the sausage is made.
Fair enough.
And I think specifically for Pixar, I think it kind of brought me to the idea I had for quite a while, that there are like different kinds of projects, different classes of projects, and one of the kind of dichotomies that I could offer for the projects is that I call open-ended and closed-ended projects. And the close-ended project would be project with a very definitive, specific goal that we have, like building a railroad between A and B. Like, in order for this thing to succeed, there is a very set of predetermined things that must be done. You cannot do, there is a very hard, real minimum of things that need to be done for this thing to succeed. And the, right. Those are like closed-ended projects. And open-ended projects would be projects like films or movies, where the success of this thing is measured post-factum. Like in case of Pixar, like Toy Story thing, it got in the box office, it got close to $400 million. And with that figure in mind, the two times budget overrun of $15 million is just minuscule. It doesn't matter. This project is a huge success. But success of that project is defined after the project has happened and only can be determined retroactively. And the way how you approach those two kinds of projects would be different.
May name a few projects and you would label them as open-ended or closed-ended.
Yeah, let's try.
Explanations. So let's say I'm building an educational platform, edtech platform.
Mm-hmm. I think this this one is tricky because it can be sort of both, right? Because if you manage to turn this into an open-ended project, this can be an open-ended, like, but this can only be done sort of retrospectively. If you develop this platform and all of a sudden there is something like inherent qualities of the problem, the approach that it takes to educate people or something else that make this thing kind of skyrocket, and you maybe hoped for like 10,000 customers for it, but for whatever reason you get 10,000 or million customers for this platform. And then in this respect, initial kind of cost overruns or whatever else might be negligible comparing to the overall success this thing has done. But then if it's just, all right, we need to deliver project XYZ and that's it, then it is more of a close-ended thing. And I think that this is what sort of works with what fuels a little bit the outsourcing industry kind of thing, right? If you hire a contractor to do something for you for the fixed cost, you limit the downside for you, like you're risking this amount. But then if this thing manages or happens to be like super successful, you keep all of the upsides from this.
All right. Example number two. I'm going on a road trip for 3 months and launching a vlog to cover the trip.
Right. I think to me this would be more on an open-ended side, because the reason for that would be first the cost of, like, you are going on the trip anyway, right? Or you're going on a trip to specific
connected thing. Like I would like to do a vlog about a 3 month road trip on a motorcycle.
No, I would put this in an open-ended category. So you probably want to approach it like a Pixar kind of movie. I don't know. Maybe start small. Mm-hmm. Like before doing a 3 month project, do a little vlog about 3 hour weekend trip or something along those lines. Like, see, show it to talk to people, talk to friends, show them something, find the voice and so on.
Mm-hmm. I'm building a house.
I think this is more than anything is a closed-ended project, because you have very specific end in mind, and it needs to hit a lot of the boxes to be considered complete and therefore successful.
You know, I can't see the difference right now, because in my case, the example with vlog,
right,
is very similar to building a house, because for both of them, you would have to do a prep stage and you could rent a house for a year to live in and see what house life actually feels like before investing into a house. And then you would probably see different projects and ideas. Like the preparation stage is very similar. The end result is also quite definitive. Like, all right, I will have 90 entries in my vlog a day, 5 minutes. I could define what they should look like. I can collect the reference points from different vlogs that I enjoy. And I could put the KPIs on the reviews and the interactions or engagement or whatever. Like, it can be done very thoroughly, or it could be done very hectic and discombobulating.
I think it also that's a fair thing, and I think I would need to throw in a new concept into this discussion, and that is like another dichotomy that I have for projects with limited versus unlimited uptake. And I think this also allows to differentiate the house project versus the vlog project kind of thing, with house, the amount of benefit you get from that is limited, right? You build a house, you kind of enjoy living in there, you save on the rent maybe, and sort of that's it. Like you are not, there is no or very little chance for you to get massively big return on your investment into building that house. It's not nil, but I think it's smaller. With the vlog, the chances are there that it can blow up and it can turn into a new career for you and bring kind of millions and stuff like that. For vlog, something like getting a fancier camera to film it can be considered as kind of investment, right? That the higher production quality may result in a better outcome of the project overall in the long term. In the house project, you can also consider using a fancier, higher quality, or maybe just fancier materials for building, for tiling, for whatever else. But there you would consider this as this is a cost. It does not necessarily skyrocket the price of a house or deliver massively disproportionate benefit to the investment that you are doing. And that's my thinking out there.
That depends on your definition on return on investment here.
Right.
Because basically, if I'm spending this money to make myself happy, then it could be an investment, because the benefit that I get from designing this library the way I'm going to use it on a daily basis, and if I get pleasure from entering this room and spending time there daily, it's a massive return on investment if you consider the benefit commercial.
Absolutely. And I think that this brings us to the idea from the book as well, like understanding what's the real goal of the project. And for some project, of course, this differentiation of open versus closed-ended doesn't make much sense. I think it makes more sense for projects where we are concerned with budget overruns, and like for that budget overrun that we get on the project, is there an opportunity for us to get kind of massive return on that investment? In case of Pixar films, I think that there is a chance for that. In case of building a bridge, maybe not so much.
But then we have this opera house, which is supposed to be something like a bridge, but then it does bring the fame to Sydney. And
right. And then I think it points to the idea of like understanding why this project was really done in the first place. Because even in the book, he talks about this project was initiated and commissioned by a politician who wanted to commemorate his name for ages to come through this project. So the project there was not to build this particular building according to this particular design with allocated budget and stuff like that. The project was for that guy to commemorate his name And I guess no one could argue that he was successful, right?
Well, then it's kind of hard to judge because I think the different people in the project had different goals. And which of the goals do you take as the project goal?
Absolutely. And I think that kind of brings us down to the discussion. Like, there are multiple factors that are important for understanding and evaluating the project. And how do you define the ones that are critical for what we are talking about? And I think the discussion we are having right now is an illustration for that. That there is, one can argue that there is a way to spin a situation in a way that can give it positive light. Likewise, there is a way to spin the situation which can be portraying what happened in a negative light. And I guess both views are sort of reasonable to an extent. We just need to be clear about which point of view we are taking or which vantage point we are taking in this particular conversation.
That is fair. I think I should consider it a bit more because right now most of the things I get in my mind as projects are both close-ended and open-ended, and it's more about an attitude or an approach, like whether you are limited in some kind of resources and what sort of benefits do you expect from that. Is it a very straightforward thing, like a road? That's a really simple example. Mm-hmm. But when it gets a bit more difficult, like a house, there is a number, layers of benefits and different ways to estimate it.
Absolutely. And we need to kind of ask ourselves a question, like how do we estimate and then find the best way to do that for this particular situation? Maybe an example of kind of close-endedness and open-endedness would be one more thing, like with the road, right? If we have road between two cities and the distance between the cities is 50 kilometers, like then we, for project to be successful, we have to build no less than 50 kilometers of the road. Otherwise, it's like zero, like the value of everything that's done below 50 kilometers is just zero. That's it. And but the benefit, of course, it's difficult to estimate and measure economical and societal benefit of having this road in place. But if we take a more constrained view of kind of this project and its budget, the goal there is to limit expenditure on this thing, right? Because then there can be a question, what's the value of building one lane road versus two lane road or versus four lane highway between the cities? But if we focus on, like, first we need to have no less than 50 kilometers of the road, and I guess in general, because of uncertainty, we want those 50 kilometers to be built in the most economical way. So to me, that would be an example of
yes, but no, because then you can always come up with an example like Transfagarashan, which is basically a road connecting two cities in the shortest possible way. Mm-hmm. But it became the destination for motorcyclists from the entire world. Like, people come there just to ride this road, they stay in the country. The touristic industry is blooming just because this road was built in this specific direction, right, in this very picturesque way.
Right. But I think there also, this is something that we can only see in retrospect, right? This can be claimed as a benefit of this project only after this has happened. You cannot claim...
Unless this guy in the book suggested the museum example as something that was actually designed to attract people, right, and the way they approach it.
Right. It was designed to attract people, and it fulfilled this purpose of attracting people, but it could also have gone the other way. It was designed to attract people, but failed to do so. Right. We should consider this as well. Then this project would be also called a failure, even though it met the budget and timetable requirements.
I think he mentioned three criteria, like delivering benefits.
Right. Yeah, the third one. And I think maybe it will help a little bit with an example of open-ended project here and contrast this to building the road. You know of this game Angry Birds, right? And I use this in a couple of presentations I gave on project management or my thoughts about managing projects. And I have the details there, but I don't remember right now precisely how many levels were in the original game that was released and was super successful and basically raised the studio out of poverty and prevented them from foreclosing because they were running out of money. And for this, like, by all means, we can call it this was a successful project in the end. But that success was not determined by the number of levels that were implemented for that game. I think it has 39 or something. Would it be like, would the outcome be materially different if it had 29 levels, then 35, 50? I argue that probably not. What was compelling there is just the idea, mechanics, and the kind of entertainment value that users got out of that game. But the what made this project a success is that, like, in the end, it generated massive return on investment for the company. And this is what I think of as an open-ended project, like Pixar movies. We don't know what were the scenes and the original story they set out to do. What matters in the end, what was this compelling thing, and was it successful?
Could I rephrase it into the fact that what you name as closed-ended projects is something that has fewer unintended impacts or usages, like something that is very utilitarian, something that is used for specifically this thing, and you know how to build it, how to design it, and most likely it's not going to do any secondary purposes.
I think it would be fair to
say. A power plant, yeah. Like this is a thing to generate that much energy,
right?
You know, how much, you know.
Yeah, there is, so like I think it may be seen as the bar for success on this project is generally higher than on open-ended projects.
And you're confusing me right now with this bar. Like, I was so close to getting it, and right now, what do you mean by the bar succeeding?
But maybe the precision of how the success is defined for those projects is different, because the building a power plant that generates like 12 megawatts per something is a rather specific requirement, right, to be fulfilled. But having a compelling story that generate in the box office more than the investment into it is a way broader, and more things can fit this definition of success.
Well, unless you define it more clearly.
Like, yes.
If you aim it to 200 million, that's a very specific target.
Yes, yes. Unless, yep. That's totally fair.
But that makes the same film both open-ended and closed-ended, depending on how you define the definition of done. Define the definition. Well done.
I think I would agree with that. Yes. It depends. So
it's not about the nature of the project itself, but
I think that this is a great point. Indeed, it may. Maybe I'll try to stretch my idea a little bit to stick to it. You're right that this may be not necessarily the inherent kind of characteristic of the project, but also it has a mindset, right? If you approach something with an open mindset, you kind of at least give yourself a chance of generating more value out of that. I would maybe suggest that with certain kind of projects, adopting open-ended mindset might be easier than with others, but then it would not be unheard of. And I think
I think
a great example of that would be once again Denmark and Copenhagen. There is a power plant, or is a kind of rubbish processing facility, one of the two, which is almost right there in the heart of the city. But it was built in a way that, in addition to just having its utilitarian purpose, it also had a goal of being more or less organic and useful part of the city's landscape there. And it was built in a way that has a rather kind of a big slope and stuff. I think I might have pictures of it. But that building in the wintertime is used as a ski slope as well, because it was built in a way. And then in the summertime, it is used also as a picnic area or something along those lines. So I guess that would be an example of approaching supposedly close-ended project with an open-ended mind and generating additional value out of it. So that would be, I would take this as an example towards supporting your point of view that this is not the nature of the project, but rather mindset adopted by those who work on the project.
Yeah, and then you could take something very open-ended, like building a community, which is a very generic thing, and define it into a community of this number of people, and they are considered community when they've done 1, 2, 3, and who they should be, and define the profile, and it turns into a club.
Yeah, and I think kind of thank you for that, really, because I think it brings my thinking about these ideas that I posted about this dichotomies between different kinds of projects to the next level. It is like, instead of having a question of what kind of project are we dealing with, open versus closed-ended, limited or limited uptake, the question, the more productive question would be, how do we turn this thing that we are set to work on into open-ended project with potentially unlimited uptake? This would be way more productive and interesting and potentially beneficial question to ask ourselves. Thank you for that.
That's quite a result, right?
Yeah, that's most certainly it is. And
people who are just listening to us, they can see that you're basically right now leaning right towards the because sun. The sun ray is just
probably
following you.
I need to be an open-ended and move in the opposite direction of where the sun is going.
That's the creativity. So, can we call it a day?
We can. We can. I think it was a great, great discussion, great book. If you are into this kind of thing that makes you think, I would definitely recommend reading this one.
Yeah, and then you could always come to our YouTube link and leave a comment to see how much you disagree with both of us or one of us.
Yep, and until then, have good weeks.
Good weeks.